and welcome to Lunching with Lawyers. Lunching with Lawyers is brought to you by LorettaCrete.com. In this series of podcasts, Loretta explores the world of law graduates. She talks to lawyers, recent law graduates, and budding lawyers seeking alternatives or exploring how to get the jobs that they want. This podcast series is also for those thinking about pivoting or just wanting to do something different. So join Loretta for discussions with lawyers and law graduates about their careers and the paths they took to get to where they are. Let's explore what success in their profession looks like to them.
Welcome to another episode of Lunching with Lawyers. Today, that is a real misnomer because the person I'm speaking to is not a lawyer and does not have a law degree. But if Noel Whittaker tells you he will come onto your podcast, it's hard to say, well, you don't meet the criteria. International best-selling author, finance and investment expert, radio broadcaster, newspaper columnist and public speaker, Noel Whittaker is one of the world's foremost authorities on personal finance. He is a member of the Order of Australia for his service to the community in raising awareness of personal finance and is currently an adjunct professor at QUT, amongst many things. A most illustrious guest, but also a genuinely good bloke. For someone like me who's practiced in the financial services area for most of my legal career, Noel is a genuine guru, but also a person who's very approachable and very generous with his time and knowledge. Joining me to interview Noel is my good friend and colleague, Catherine Ewer, another member of Noel's fan club. Thank you, Catherine and Noel. So, Noel, what did you think of Inala when you met me for lunch there last year? I heard it was the first time you'd ever been there.
Yes, but I think I'd like to start with the fact that I'm a half-qualified lawyer because I was working in a law office as a conveyancer and I did half a law degree and it's given me a very good knowledge on the basics of law, so it's a handy thing to have.
But why did you stop then practising? Why didn't you go through with it?
Well, it wasn't what I wanted, I don't think.
Why did you start then?
Well, I was talked into joining a law firm. Yeah. I love law, but I like torts and crim.
Oh, really?
Torts and crim. I used to love torts and crim. I can still remember all the cases.
Oh, and what case can you remember in torts?
Dabblestein's case is
you
one.
The bloody pencil.
Dabblestein's case. There was Hedleyburn and Heller. There's Wagon Mound. You name it. You know, Donoghue versus Stevenson.
Oh, we all know. Even I remember Donoghue and Stevenson.
That's McAllister's case.
Yeah.
I know them.
I'm going to jump in. So, can you remember any hairy conveyances? Given that conveyancing was done very differently, when you had to go down and draw the cheque and take it across.
I know. I think the thing about conveyancing is it normally goes very well, but when it goes bad, boy, does it go bad. That's the thing about conveyancing.
Hmm. Well, it's better in Queensland, surely, than in New South Wales or England, where things just take so long and are drawn out.
I know. Well, at least we've got time of the essence here. But then I left law and did accounting. So there you are. And I topped Australia in tax. So
really?
Tax became my specialty. So I've sort of now niched to tax. And every time I have a conversation, if you say you're doing something, I go straight to tax. What are the tax implications?
Okay. So
it's automatic.
I can't believe you topped Australia. So what's your...
I mean, you can't believe. I didn't just top it. I got the highest mark in history, 99.9%.
Oh, really?
Income tax law in practice, yeah. That was 1961, I think.
Really? That long ago?
Long time ago. That was before you were born, Loretta. That's right, yeah.
Yes, so a long time before
before you were born.
And so where was that, Noel? What university was that?
Well, it was through the Barristers' Board. So my lecturers were Bob Greenwood and Jim Gibney. He was a Chief Crown Prosecutor. And Ian Hanger.
So that was Jim Gibney that we know, was that his father?
Yes, that's...
Yes.
District Court Judge.
Yeah. They were great.
That's really interesting.
It was great fun. I used to love them, yeah.
Yeah, we worked for many years with Jim Gibney at Legal Aid. Yeah,
Junior. Yeah.
Obviously, yeah. So.
Oh, yes. Amazing. It's a small world.
But it's true, isn't it, that lawyers frequently don't properly consider tax implications, and so it's constantly a problem that if you don't really understand the tax implications for every decision, whether it be family law or insolvency or just general mergers and acquisitions, it's a problem.
So, but also you learn on the job. If you haven't struck it, you don't know it. I mean, and I think the big one is reverse mortgages. Now, I was dealing with some reverse mortgages where the break fee was more than the debt. And people say they should have had legal advice, but I don't think any lawyer, unless they'd struck it, would know to look for that.
I absolutely agree with you on that. Do you know there's a case running at the moment on the Gold Coast where I think the break fee is over $1 million?
Yes.
So, yeah. So it'd be really interesting to see how they go on that one.
Well, they spoke to me about that one. Yes. Yes.
So, yes. Well, we'll keep
and
that.
And I think in that case, if it's the one that we're talking about, they sold their house on an unconditional cash settlement. And I think they signed a contract to buy something else using the proceeds. But now the proceeds of their sale will be wiped out by the debt. So they have now lost the entire property.
It's an extraordinary thing, those reverse mortgages.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, everybody was always talking about how good they were. I remember when they first came about in the mid-2000s, and people were going to saying this is a wonderful thing for elderly people and that they'll do so well out of it. But I just couldn't see how anyone would think that was reasonable, that they lose all their equity in their home over a period of time, particularly if they had children and particularly if they wanted to do other things like going to a nursing home at some stage and sell their property before they died.
True, but when the first ones came out, I'm going back to Advanced Bank now. I think you had to be over 75 to minimise the term. And I think the maximum loan was 12% of your house value.
And house prices were still always going up.
Well, hopefully, yes. Yes.
Doubling in every seven.
Well, don't start me on that one. Don't start me on that one.
Yeah.
That's complete rubbish.
So that was never the case.
Well, if a house doubles every 7 years, it's increasing at 10% a year. So $500,000 today and $1 million in 7 years and $2 million in 14 years and $4 million in 21 years. And come on.
Even I can now understand that.
No. Well, not going to happen.
Well, that's why the most interesting thing from your book, Money Made Simple, was
Making
that
Money Made Simple.
Making Money Made Simple was that rule of 72, which I'd never heard of. And now it just makes real sense. But do you want to tell us, do you want to tell my
audience,
great audience?
Your lovely audience.
My lovely
Many
audience.
Many of whom who won't know how you came to write the book.
Yes, well, we'll go back to that.
That's another story.
Yeah.
There's a great story in that. That's an amazing story.
Well, tell us the story, Noel.
Of the book or the Rule of 72?
Well, both.
In whichever order you want to.
Okay, well, I've always liked to write. In primary school, I used to win essay prizes. When I was young, I kept a diary. When I was 18, I was keeping a diary, some of which are no longer there, sadly. And when we started the real estate business at Springwood, I noticed the hairdresser had a 400-word article in the Albert and Logan News called, I think it was called Snippets. I thought, which she paid for. And I thought, that's a good idea. I'll write one on real estate. So I started to write a weekly column on real estate tips because I was a real estate agent then, being a conveyancer and an accountant. I was, you know, well placed.
Yes.
But nothing happened. And all of a sudden, after about 6 months, because these things take time to build, people started to keep them and quote them. And I thought, this is okay. And then I eventually I hired a PI guy and he got me writing a column in the Courier Mail called Key Money. That was around roughly late 1980s, sort of. And then 4BC asked me if I'd like... Then what happened was... this will be edited, of course.
No, it won't be.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to put all this in sequence.
Because I think, can we just say this? Because I think you wrote Making Money Made Simple in 1987. 86. So it must have been before then that you started writing.
It was,
for
but
the
we
Courier.
Started with the somehow, of course, I've got it. The REIQ picked me as one of six people in Queensland real estate who'd make good presenters. And they said, if you pay your way to Canberra, we'll give you a two-day course on presentation with Bob Maloof, who was probably the top trainer in Australia. Three people said, haven't they got a cheek? They won't pay the airfares. And three of us went.
And who were the three?
I don't know. I'm going back a long time. But one thing I got out of that, heaps of things out of it, but if you make a speech, you must give a handout. And it just happened then. I go back to Brisbane and the ABC rang because they'd seen my columns in the Courier Mail. I would like to do a thing tonight on budgeting. Thinking about what I'd learned in Canberra, I said, well, really, we need the audience to have something to look at. I said, the Courier Mail does articles on the stars. They do a star chart. Let's do a budget. They said, yes. And the Courier Mail bought the idea. Now I've got the ABC and the Courier Mail both promoting me. And it went well. It was a once only. And I got a call the next day from two guys from Sydney. We were in a motel in Brisbane. We heard you on the ABC. We would like you to write a book for the Daily Mail in Sydney. I said, okay. So I wrote the book about making money principles. It was all going fine. Then suddenly said, well, it's not going to work. We can't sell it. So I kept the copyright and I got a $5,000 fee. So now I've got the copyright and the guts of a book. Then 4BC rang and said, well, we'd like to do a radio program Saturday morning at 6 o'clock. 6 o'clock Saturday morning? Well, that's when all the fishermen listen, all the racing guys. It was just before the scratchings. A lot of people go to bed fairly soz on Friday nights and forget to turn off their alarm. So it's a big audience, 6 o'clock, 4BC, Saturday morning.
Isn't that surprising?
Yeah. And one day a woman rings up, oh, no, you talk good stuff on the radio, you write good stuff in the paper. Is there a book about it? I said, I'll go and check. I checked the bookstores. There was nothing at all. Nothing. There were books like, you know, How to Get 100 Properties in 2 Years and all this sort of rubbish, but very complex books that thick full of graphs and small print. I said, I'll write the book. So that was 84, I think, or 85. Then I did a course in October 85, a five-day live-in course called Vision Quest. And at that course, I made a vow that I would write the book. So I went home and Geraldine, my wife, said to me, she said, you got to start. I said, it's Boxing Day. It doesn't matter, start.
Now, so, again, behind every great man, there's
of course,
a great woman.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I said, okay, that's okay. But a book is too big a goal. You know, a book's 80,000 words. The goal is too big. But like all goals, which I've learnt since, I can write 40 chapters. So I can't write a book of 80,000 words, but I can write down 40 chapter headings. And having done that, I can then write 42,000 word chapters. And that's how the book got started.
And I'm going to jump in. So did you have a discipline of writing at a certain time? You know, did you get up in the morning and write, or how did you manage it just in terms of...
There's a guy, Anthony Trollope, who wrote The Palisades. He was a postal clerk in Britain. He paid his groom 5 guineas a year to wake him at 5 a.m. And he had to write 500 words every day without fail. Now, 500 words every day is 15,000 words a month. In 3 months, you got 50,000 words.
So it's just like making money.
You just got to do it. It's a discipline. You've just got to say, I will do it. See, most people say, I want to write a book. Oh, but that's too hard to start. You must write your 500 words every day without fail. There's a famous saying, a cobbler doesn't wait for inspiration. He goes to his shop and cobbles boots. So it's late 86. I've now got a manuscript, a big ugly thing in a folder. And I start to take it around publishers. Ah, too many books about money now. I don't want it, you know. And then my friend Gordon Miles, my accountant, said, well, he said, and there's a publisher, Les Padman at Boolarong Press. We'll talk to Les. So Les had his people read it. He said, I think it may sell, but we really can't afford to publish it. But if you pay the costs, we will be the publisher. So instead of giving my life and soul to a publisher, I kept the book. And I simply paid the production costs of the book. And I owned the book. And Boolarong Press took a percentage. Well, now, if you can sell 5,000 copies of a book in Australia, it's big time. We sold 5,000 in the first month. Then Gary Hargrave picked it up and did it on the 7:30 report. Then Des Houghton did it in the Sunday Mail. It just took off. It became the number one bestseller. It sold 100,000 copies in a year. It had the $20 note on the cover. One in six households had it. And everybody knew somebody in the household who needed it. That was the whole trick. Oh, you need this one. You got to buy this book. And that's how it got going. And, of course, then that led to stuff in the paper. And I'm now being in the newspapers because they wanted me as a regular columnist.
And that came from the book rather than the other way around.
From the book, oh, yes.
I just wasn't sure whether you'd first gone to the broadcasting and then wrote the book.
No, so it all sort of snowballed. But a lot of people, I mean, that book made me a lot of money. But I kept on going. A lot of people make it a fizzer, and I built on the book. So we then end up with the biggest financial advisory service in Queensland.
Because you started that back in the 70s, didn't you?
No, that was in the 80s.
Right. So you didn't. But I thought you started it after reading Think and Grow Rich.
No, I read Think and Grow Rich in 1975, and that was the life changer for me. But we started the building business, then the real estate business. Then that became a mortgage lender. And then that morphed into a financial planning firm. Because the industry was just getting going around 83. So we were the first ones.
So you started Whittaker McNaught in 83.
It used to be Whittaker Hurst McNaught.
Well, I was going to say, did you start by yourself or were you always with partners?
Well, they were my real estate team. I mean, Trevor Hurst, Cheryl McNaught was my PA. Trevor Hurst worked for me, but he was an ex-IBM person. So we got together because we had nothing.
And where was the real estate agency that you had?
It's Springwood.
And this was, when you say it was at Springwood, but obviously we're talking about a very different place to Springwood now in terms of, so it was mainly acreage or was it?
No. When I read Think and Grow Rich, I made two vows. I'll have my own business within 100 days, it took 160. And I'll spend the rest of my life promulgating the Napoleon Hill principles.
Which are what?
The 13 principles. And my son James, who lives in Los Angeles, is now the foremost person in the world on the Napoleon Hill principles. He just released another book called Metal Dynamite, where Andrew Carnegie, the world's wealthiest man, met Napoleon Hill. So he's now been picked up by Sterling Press. Sterling Press owned Barnes & Noble and Waterstones, and he's now their top author. So James is now the Napoleon Hill Foundation owns the rights to Think and Grow Rich, which has sold 140 million copies. And James is now their poster boy. So I haven't just, I mean, so my son is really the one promulgating them. But anyway, how that, what happened then, I was doing joint ventures with a builder. I said, right, I've got the accounting and the conveyancing and the sales skills. How about we go into business? So we went into the business as Whittaker & Francis in a real estate and building company. And we built spec houses. And, well, nothing happened. And one Sunday, I'm sitting in the office and the phone wasn't going. Nothing was happening. And we'd built a street. We'd built a street in Rochdale with about 10 homes there. We were buying the land for $8,000. We'd build the house for 12 and sell it for 30. So 8 for the land, 12 for the house. That was 12 or 20, and we sold it for 30. That was what it was back in 1975. And dash me, I saw a couple gazing in the window. And I went up and spoke to them, and I sold them the house. And I said, right, you don't do business sitting on your bum. You get out and you find it. So I then, against all the council regulations, bought 100 Corfleet signs, about a metre by a metre, and every Saturday I'd put them on every telephone post around Rochdale called Camden Homes Arrow, and the street was full of people. So we were the first open house builder.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I sort of invented it as far as I know.
And at that stage, were they going to the Big Four for finance?
Real estate, for the big banks, yes.
Yes, of course. Those who were going in were getting their money from the banks at that point.
Yes, but just bear in mind, this is, I know this will be hard to believe for your younger people, around 1978 there was no finance. No. You couldn't get finance.
Oh, really?
Doesn't matter if you were a doctor married to a doctor with $100,000 deposit, it was very difficult. You couldn't get finance.
So how did people purchase home?
Well, you did deals with building societies and the vendor promised to leave some money there and stuff.
Well, I must admit, I think my father bought his first home in Australia when they migrated out here through a finance company.
Yeah.
You know, got the loan. I think he paid it off within 12 months because, like you said, they couldn't get a loan from a bank to buy it.
And then rates went mad and they fixed rates at 13.5. The average buyer was paying 18% for a housing loan. People don't have no idea. That was the way it was.
No, and then there was the 80s where the vendor would want to get out of the contract because they'd have a better offer.
That's right.
5 to 10 days later.
Yes.
And there were all these actions for specific performance of contracts.
Of course.
Which again would be just nobody would understand that now.
Exactly.
And people paying off blocks of land at 18% and so you're not being able to have enough money to build.
I know. It was different. And often then the part that didn't work, so we're trying to work on one income. But I ran the numbers. When I wrote the first book, I said if the average couple on the average wage bought the average house and used one wage to pay off the mortgage, in 5 years they are debt-free with rates at 13%. Today, with rates at 4%, average couple, average wage, average house, in 10 years, the debt's under control at today's low rate. So you can see how much more expensive a house is. Like when we had those homes at Rochdale for $30,000, the average wage was $15,000 a year. So we were selling homes at 2 times average earnings. Now average earnings are $70,000. Average home's about 600, so it's about 8 times average earnings. So homes are much, much dearer.
They are dearer, but it is still doable.
It's doable if you want to do it.
Yes.
As Bernard Salt said, if you don't spend all your money on avocado on toast, and you know, because people do some very silly things.
What's the silliest thing that you think young people are doing these days?
Tattoos. Why don't we just spend $10,000 on tats, for God's sake? And we just had a building job done. The tradies all smoke. Cigarettes are now $50 a packet. It's $2 a smoke. That's $18,000 a year.
It's so a very slow way to die too.
Well, absolutely. So if you put like 5,000 for the tasnodine for smokes, you're wasting 25 grand a year just on that.
Mm.
Plus they've got the hotted up cars.
I think to a certain extent, like there are some things that people, young people could do to save their deposits and do those sorts of things. I think it is tougher, but you're right, there are a lot more things that people can spend their money on these days as well.
Exactly, but you must have a goal. Mm. See, it all starts with goals. The first Think and Grow Rich principle was desire. You must have a desire. Many people don't have a desire.
No.
They don't. And then when you have a desire, you then set the goals, and the goals are what govern the action to reach your desire. And once you start to write the goals down, things happen. It's extraordinary what goals do.
I'd love to know if you'd influenced anybody at 6 a.m. on a Saturday morning to change some of their pattern in terms of their bedding.
I'm not sure about that. But what I can say is like letters, emails every day from people saying, I read your book 20 years ago and my life has changed.
Mm.
I get that feedback all the time.
Because you made it doable. Again, you've chunked it down into take these steps. You can take these small steps.
Yes. And as we speak, I've finished my book on retirement, Retirement Made Simple, which will be launched by Christmas 2020.
I was going to ask you what your next project was.
Yes.
And what's the, so what's your current view about equity release? Obviously, many people are squeamish, thinking that they're asset rich, they've got children who they would like to give a start to. If you don't understand the interplay between Social Security and tax, then you're going to make mistakes. What are your current thoughts about what people should be doing in terms of...
Well, I'm a great believer. You give your kids money, if you can, when they need it, not when I'm 90 and they're going to be 65 or something.
Mm.
So if they're good kids, it's called a help, a hand up, not a hand out. If they're good kids, help them. We've helped all our kids with their houses. They're all great kids. But if they were wasters, they'd get nothing.
Mm.
You can always say, well, you know, if you save a dollar, I'll give you $10 or whatever. So you help them along. But that's not equity release. Equity release is when older people try to get money because they're cash poor.
Or they want to help out.
Well, you should never borrow to help your kids out. There's no way a retiree should borrow to help their kids out.
So it's just as simple as that. That's basically... Oh,
absolutely.
Don't do it.
Well, it's a basic principle. You only borrow if you have to. Nobody has to borrow to give their kids a start. You know, kids learn by getting their own start. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And so the timing of helping out those kids is much earlier than retirement. That's the other point that you've just made. That
if you can afford it and if they're the right kids, absolutely. No question. No question.
I must admit I have the same views about equity release. I mean, this sort of tragedy that I've seen, things going wrong, you really don't want to be doing what... Equity release, reverse mortgages.
So, and for, this is where you take money out of the house that you've got because your mortgage is so small, so you borrow against your house for whatever purpose. That's what equity release is for anyone who's listening and isn't quite sure.
Well, not quite. That's one way. You're getting a loan and making no payments of principal or interest. Now, the current rate's about 6%, so every 12 years your debt will double. I had a client, he was a single man, never married. He said, I'm 80. Why not? I said, absolutely. I mean, you're 80, you're probably going to get to 90. You got a house worth $500,000. Why not borrow a couple of hundred grand and enjoy it? That's fine. But if you've got, you know, but that's the point. Everybody wants to die broke, but no one knows the day they will. Everyone wants to use all their money up by the day they die, but no one knows the date they die. And historically, people underestimate their life expectancy.
Oh, well, I would have thought most people think they're going to live forever.
No, they'll not think that when they're 16 and they're tearing around on the drugs and hooning, but I mean, no. So, but there's other equity. See, there's another scheme at the moment where you can where you can sell a part of your house to your self-managed fund under the downsizing rules. That's just happened. And I think Bendigo Bank can become a part owner and take a bit of your house. But all this means, no matter how it's gilded, is that you're spending money now which the kids aren't going to get, which is why the family should be involved. And really, if you only want to borrow 50 grand, if the kids pay the interest, the debt won't increase.
Mm.
If you borrow 50 grand at 5%, the interest is only 50 bucks a week. If the kids cover that, it's fine.
And I think this is one of the problems, is that the children are often not involved and then are really surprised about it. And, you know, parents then feel guilty too because they think that they're going to have something to give to their kids and they end up with nothing.
Exactly. Mm. And I've also got a lawyer friend, an elder lawyer, and he says there is a lot of dysfunctional families.
Mm.
He's had a case where one couple spent $35,000 on mediation to see who got mum on Christmas Day. And there's often four siblings and they're fighting.
Mm.
To make it worse, almost everyone now has a sibling living overseas, which makes it more complex. And in my friend's book, which will be released in March, is a terrible day when the woman's busy and the kids are screaming and the boss is screaming and the phone call comes. Mum's had a fall and she won't be coming home.
Mm.
That's the life changer. Who will take care of her? What will it cost? Where will she go?
And we don't have a rich array of safe options in Australia, or at least currently as we're talking, we've got problems down south because independent living might be safe, but going into some nursing homes doesn't seem like a safe option.
Exactly.
So, and independent living often has nursing homes attached to it, but nobody looks carefully at the nursing homes when they're going into the independent living. They're looking at what does the independent living look like? Has it got a northeast aspect?
Is
it comfortable?
Sure.
And so many people don't want to live with family. Because they also see that that's not a safe option either. So I'm not sure how you work out what to do, especially when you don't have a large amount of money to spend.
Well, it's difficult. And also you've got elder abuse. I mean, there's now plenty of cases where the kid has got the power of attorney and is spending the money, but it's tricky because it might be the only child and he might be the sole beneficiary anyway. So he's actually drawing his money early, which he shouldn't be doing, of course. But how do you find out? How do you report it?
I think that's those sorts of things are always tricky because also parents may not be, as an outsider, you may think, well, this parent is or this person's being taken advantage of, but the parent may not necessarily feel taken advantage of.
Of course.
Think, that's my child. I can give them whatever I want.
Yes.
And they're very tricky situations to navigate, I think. And
yes.
It needs to be done. It can't, there's not one size fits all, I think, in those sorts of situations.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I think, my father would be very annoyed if I told him how he should spend his money or not.
I know. But then, of course, you've got dementia as well. I mean, you've got...
Oh, you've got varying capacity. So you've got the declining capacity. So one day they're good, the next day their capacity can be down. So how do you manage those sorts of things? Because a person may have made a decision when they had capacity, or they might have made it in the afternoon when they may not have had such good capacity. So,
but hopefully you've got a good, enduring power of attorney.
Mm.
But most people also don't know that there's certain assets are not part of your will, such as anything in joint tenants, anything in superannuation and insurance bonds.
Mm.
But a leading case in New South Wales this year, a guy died. He left his wife of 57 years marriage. It was joint tenants. The 61-year-old disabled son successfully sued to break the joint tenancy to get, and the house was forced to be sold. That was the leading case in New South Wales this year.
Really?
Yes.
And that's partly because the law's always recognised that some people are dependent on the person who's deceased, and they therefore should get enough to continue to enable that dependency to continue. And strangely enough, it's also the opposite. So it's either the person you were giving to the person who deceased and therefore ought to be compensated for that, or else the other way around, you were dependent on them and you ought to be continually supported for that. Mm. So it's, I don't think, most people don't understand that.
But to break a joint tenancy, I mean, that made new law.
It's unusual.
It's a huge law, yes.
Mm.
And it was actually, it was an appeal court decision. So the first judge did it and the appeal court confirmed it on the basis of need.
Mm-hmm. So what sort of things are you, can you give us a little bit about what you're talking about in your new book? Can you give us a few teasers?
Well, it's 87,000 words and retirement is a massive topic.
Mm-hmm.
You've got, where am I going to invest at the moment?
That's what I was going to ask you, a question.
It's very confusing, isn't it?
What do you think is some investment tips during COVID?
Well, investment tips are basic. It's like health tips and marriage tips, every other tip. I mean, the basics work. If you need growth assets like shares to get the returns that you need. Mm. Otherwise, you won't live as long as your money will die before you do. But you must keep at least 4 years' assets in cash type investments, so you're never forced to be dumping your good shares at a time when the market's having a normal downturn. That's the first one.
Mm.
Now, when the dividends suddenly got slashed, a lot of retirees didn't do that rule. They said, oh, no, the dividends are coming. Well, the dividends got stopped, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. They're not paying out right now.
No, that's it. Yeah, a lot of retirees love their bank shares. Now, when they stopped, they didn't know what to do. So you need that cash buffer. That's the first important thing. Secondly, make sure your estate planning's right. Understand investor psychology. I mean, look at Mayfair. The papers have been full of Mayfair offering these amazing returns. One guy I saw in the paper, he put his life savings, $700,000, into Mayfair. It's all gone.
Wow.
Like, we've got so many of these. In my new book, I've got 12 examples of scams.
Now, all the banks, as I understand it today, have pulled out of investment advice. Is that right? They're not offering it in-house again, or is it just something?
I don't think
that
that's right. The problem is that the industry's been so stuffed about by regulators.
Mm-hmm.
They now say, I can't give you advice unless I know your situation totally. That's a 3-hour interview and a 100-page document. And that's $3,000 up front before we start. Now, you know, so what's the average person going to do? The banks have been flogging their own product. My daughter worked at Westpac. Mm. Every morning they were given a target. And at lunchtime there was a meeting, how's your target going? At 3 p.m. it was name and shame. You got yours, you missed yours. It was a
wow.
Every teller was paid for sales
every
leads.
Day.
Every teller had to get X leads for the financial planning every day. Cross-selling.
Mm. So what's the solution?
That's been banned, I think.
Mm.
Well, it's difficult. Mm. It's hard to get advice. This is the point. But most advisors are quite good. And, of course, advisors have got a bad name now because of a few. But most advisors are pretty good.
Well, that's the thing. I think the community is used to getting it for free. So if you're used to getting it for what you thought was free, then it's hard now to say, well, you've got to pay up $3,000 to $5,000 to get that advice and get proper advice about it.
But if you came to our business back here in 1990, wanted to invest $100,000, we got a 2% commission.
Mm.
So we got paid $2,000 by the fund manager.
Yeah.
And possibly a trail and some products.
Well, the whole purpose of the trail was that instead of getting 2% up front, I got 1% up front and 0.5% for the life to compensate me for taking care of you.
Mm.
So that was the way trails worked, because otherwise the advisor had no income. If the advisor's sole income from new clients, the richer stage he's got more than he can handle. So it was either a trail or charge the clients.
Or because otherwise, if you didn't have the trail and just had the upfront fee, there's an incentive for you to keep moving the client, in a sense.
Advisor, because which is called churning.
Churning.
Yes. So.
How do you, I mean, it's such a difficult subject because people do find it difficult, even if you had $100,000,
yeah,
which is not a lot. It is a significant amount of money for some people, but to actually pay out 5% for upfront advice about that would be very expensive, and you'd be thinking, well, if I pay it up front here to get really independent advice and I can get it here for nothing, people just are very short-sighted, I think, Noel.
But see, if I said to you, you want to invest $500,000, the trail fee, say, 0.5, so I'll get $2,500 a year, no trouble. If I said to you, I will charge you $3,000 a year, you'd say, no way. It's like nobody minds the tax taken out of their pay.
Yeah.
But Dad asked them to pay $1 of tax. They could have $20,000 taken out, no trouble at all. But Dad asked them to write a check for $10,000, $20,000. And that's why there's group tax. Mm. Otherwise, nobody could pay their tax. When I was in France last year, there were riots in the streets because Paris was moving from pay all your tax in October to monthly out of your payroll. And they were rebelling against it. And to me, it's somewhat basic. Gee, why would you give anyone a bill for their tax every 12 months?
You know?
People don't miss what's taken from them.
No, that's true.
Which is why I was saying one of the big things in my first book was pay your mortgage payments fortnightly and you'll save a fortune. Because if you're paying $4,000 a month and you go to $2,000 a fortnight, you're paying $52,000 and not $48,000.
And it just so happens that in Queensland, we're more likely to be paid fortnightly.
Yes.
There are other places where monthly payments, like Singapore and other places, where it's just much more the way people are paid.
Sure.
But we're not. Most of us are being paid fortnightly.
Mm.
And for those of us who pay our own tax, it's true for about 2 or 3 months of the year. Families hear the screeching and the ranting and the raving and turn off all the lights and get out of the shower and I'm going to be ruined, I can't pay my tax.
Then they forget about it.
Yes.
And they're back to square one again. Human nature.
Now, I'm going to ask you some questions, so
here we
some
go.
Some particular questions that I wanted answered. Actually, this is rather interesting because, of course, I did a bit of research about you.
Oh, thanks. Thank you for that.
Just a little bit. But in a previous article written about you, you mentioned that you give money to the Hear and Say Centre. So can I personally say thank you to you, as my daughter accessed speech therapy through Hear and Say Centre when she was young, when resources for children were very scant. But the question that I wanted to ask from that, why did you give money to that charity in preference to others?
Okay. I started the foundation 3 years ago.
Mm.
And you've got to have, I think it's important, the best pleasure I get is helping other people. But it's got to be, I like the story of the apple and the seeds.
Mm.
One seed can produce 1 million apples. So I'm not in, and I know there's different views on this.
Mm.
All my charitable stuff is based on changing lives going forward. If I can help your daughter today, that'll help her kids and her relationship, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. I'm not into make a wish. I don't do palliative care. I, mm. I, I'm in the scholarship thing at QUT where I gave them $125,000, which for the next 1,000 years will give a scholarship to one child from an underprivileged family a year.
Mm.
So all my charitable stuff is about changing lives for the long term in the hope that they'll also change their partners and their kids.
I think that's a really...
It's a multiplier effect, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a really... I must say the Hear and Say Centre was pretty good in that way.
Oh, yeah.
Really wanting people to speak, yeah.
Yes,
it's a great thing.
Yes.
Next question, because I have all these questions.
I'm terrified.
So what practical steps or advice would you give to a young person if they wanted to follow your varied and interesting career? To how they could do that.
You start with improving your skills.
Mm.
You improve your skills, you improve your contacts, you improve your earning ability.
How do you improve your contacts?
Well, the people you meet. I mean, if you go to a course, you meet people.
Mm. And how do you keep those contacts alive?
Well, in my life, I've found that contacts sometimes are transient.
Mm.
Some people are your contacts now, and maybe in 5 years' time, there's different contacts. It's just the way it moves. But once you start to mix with other people, where you'll be in 5 years depends on the books you read and the people you meet. So you mix with winners. You mix with people who share your values and goals. You don't mix with the other side. You don't mix with whingers. In my book on retirement, there's a big chapter on self-talk. Mm. One of the most deadly things of older people, I'm too old for that. You know, look at her, she's elderly. I can't do that. You know, self-talk is one of the most important things. And you've got to really decide this. You've got to decide to succeed.
Mm.
That's the first thing. So improve your skills and things happen.
Right.
Once you start to improve your skills, I mean, then you'll be the one with promotion. I mean, if you're working in a dress shop, then you'll be the one that goes the extra mile and then you'll get the manager's job. Then you may want to start your own dress shop. If you're a waiter, you know, then you can become the head waiter and you can start a restaurant. I mean, you improve your skills with the goal, if it's for you, of starting your own business. Once you start your own business, you are then in control of your income and your life. And once you've got your own business, you learn an awful lot, believe me.
Very quickly. My daughter's starting her own coffee van.
That's great. That's
it's
great.
Been very, she asked me about, do you have to pay tax? What's tax?
If you make money, you'll pay tax. Make money, you'll pay tax.
I said, yes, you have to pay tax. So
is she doing her own or is she joining Phil Goff's franchise?
No. She bought her own little van. I mean, with a little help from Mum.
Yeah.
But she did save a lot of money herself. But I was actually talking to someone who works in the tax department and I said to him, one of the things that I think that they could do more for young people, particularly she's not well educated or, you know, she's not the brightest young woman, you know, she's struggled really hard, is that they could do more to really encourage those really young, you know, under 25s to start their own business and the sort of things that they would need to do. Because I said to her, you know, you need to start up simple books. And she's really looking at me very confused about this. So, you know, those sorts of things, they could do a lot more if they want those young people to be entrepreneurial and do those.
I'll give you a copy of my Beginner's Guide to Wealth, which is written for her.
Oh,
Beginner's
good.
Guide to Wealth.
Oh, excellent.
I use your calculators off your website. I find them easy.
Aren't they great?
Oh, yeah. They're easy to use than many that are everywhere else.
That's right.
And they have... And they're not having pop-up stuff that obscures my ability to use the calculator.
That's good.
So, I'm given that I'm providing a lot of advice and need to provide it quickly and simply, I find them very useful. So,
yeah, in social security.
But it isn't an obvious thing, communicating directly, even so clearly as you have, with a philosophy of why you choose to do what you do and how you do it. Most people haven't got very well formulated philosophies about what they do.
It's no, they just don't.
Stumble this over this way.
But the whole thing is, if you've got a coffee van, right, you've got fixed expenses and variable expenses. The first 100 cups of coffee are paying the rent on the coffee van. Then it's the extra coffees where the profit is. This is why COVID makes it so hard for restaurants, because it's the last tables where the profit is. If you cut down your capacity to sell, you're just killing the bottom line. It's a famous saying, if you can add 10% to your sales and reduce your cost by 10%, your bottom line's up by 35%.
Wow.
So your daughter needs to understand that it's not the coffee where the money is, it's the donut with it.
Yes.
She's if you go to Macca's, it's always fries, Macca's upsell, because there's no money in a Big Mac, but all the money's in the Coke and the French fries. You know, that's the whole thing. You've got to understand that extra value.
Okay, well.
It's like if you buy a car, the money's in the accessories.
That's you're, right. They always try and push you to
of course. Well, you're, oh, the car's cheap. Right, now you've got our finance man will do the loan for you. And what about the mats and the tinting and the waxing?
And how much did you get on your Tesla with those accessories?
Well, they don't have a Tesla doesn't have accessories.
Oh, really?
No.
So you get it just the way it is.
As it is. Tesla comes, that's what it is. But having had my car back into a wall...
I heard about that.
in auto park, which it asked me to put it in, and I accepted.
You have it in romance mode, which I understand is a mode on a Tesla.
Well, that's where you have a wood fire in the front seat, a national wood fire. But the Tesla backed itself into a wall. Tesla then say, which I think I should ask your legal advice on this, I think. They say if you choose auto park or auto drive, we have no responsibility. Yet they market the cars on this.
Wow.
You know, Tesla's the one saying the self-driving car's coming.
Yes.
We're a long way from the self-driving car.
Yeah, they're just at the beginning of it.
Well, a self-driving car needs the two white lines on the road to drive.
Yes.
So it can't drive in a suburban street to start with.
Ah, I see.
And it doesn't like sharp bends. It tends to go on the wrong side of the road. And the Tesla regularly goes blank. So it reboots itself and then it'll automatically give itself a reboot. So you drive along, suddenly the screen goes black. What the hell's happening? And then you just drive along. Hopefully it's okay because you can't see any gauges or anything. You wouldn't know what speed you're doing. So you try and gauge the other cars around you and it comes back on. So there's a bit of work in the Tesla
it's
yet.
Not quite there yet.
Not quite.
No, it's not quite there at all, no.
So maybe that's one of your current challenges, but are there any other challenges that you've got at the moment? No.
Well, I guess I've got to finish. The book's written. It's with the editor's finished. Next thing, it'll become a PDF. Then I've got to place the cartoons. I've got to get a final look at the book. It's got to look right. Then I've got to market it. And I've got to do the author's tour. Now, so it's never stops.
Yeah, but that's wonderful.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it.
Really? I mean, that's, you know, when you were saying about you should never say, I can't do that anymore.
That's right.
Because
never.
It doesn't matter what age you start doing things. I think that's a really good advice to anyone, really, because some people say at 25 or 30, I can't do that anymore. I'm too old.
The number of guys that golf, I'm having a bad day today. I can't putt today. That's good. I get the money off you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. But I finished the book on the Clint Eastwood story. He and Toby Keith, the songwriter, the singer, were at Pebble Beach in 2018 at a charity day in the golf buggy. And Clint was just doing his film, The Mule. And Toby Keith said, how does someone 86, 88 keep going? He said, it's simple. I get up every day and do my work and I never let the old man in. And Toby Keith picked that up. And that's where the old man in song came from.
Ah.
You don't let the old man in. I mean, Jerry Harvey's 81, Kerry Stokes is 80, John Howard's 82, Warren Buffett's 90. You just keep doing what you're doing.
It's such good advice. And, you know, hopefully that comes through in your retirement book, because I think that's a lot of things that people, not just in their 80s, but in their 60s and 50s, yeah, really need to hear, because a lot of times people start to write people off once they get into, yes, you know, their 50s, 60s, mm-hmm, 70s, and say, well, that's over for them. And I think it's far from over.
The number of jokes I get, you know, jokes, it's like the blonde jokes, it's like the old people's jokes.
Mm.
I don't read them, I just delete them. I don't do senile jokes.
Mm.
You know, I don't have senior moments.
No.
At times I forget what I'm doing. It doesn't matter. My mind's so busy, it's, oh, it'll come back to me.
Mm.
That's the point. You've got to be positive and you've got to have the right self-talk.
So, where to next for Noel Whittaker after the book?
Well, it may be the last book, I think, uh-huh, because I think I've done them all. I've done the young person's, uh-huh, book, and I've done the, uh-huh, middle-aged person's book. I think I'll then be more in the social media thing, with more on Facebook, more on Twitter. I've got a monthly newsletter which has got 20,000 people. It's like an institution. Everywhere you go, someone's read it. Oh, so I read it about you today in the newsletter. So it's become an institution and it's free.
And where's that? No.
It just comes out off my website,
mm,
every month. But I can make that fortnightly. My goal is to keep educating people about money. And there's so much to educate them about.
Isn't it funny? Because a lot of the principles that you talked about in Making Money Made Simple are really not... They're not complicated, really.
They're not complicated. You know,
and I mean, Catherine and I have worked in this area for a very long time. Yeah. And
you've got to remember that a lot of your audience is in the Catherine category. The reason they ignore us is because they can't add up. So yeah, it might seem complicated, but it's all right. Oh, okay.
But I am often surprised at how little the practical side of finances has. I don't know why it hasn't filtered through, because it doesn't seem that difficult. I know, Catherine, I think you're being self-deprecating, but and it really surprises me how much people don't understand finances and, you know.
But what's there to understand? I mean, you spend less than you earn.
Yes.
And there's a thing, the Clayton's budget, you simply write down your fixed expenses. Like your rent, mortgage payments, insurance, school fees, phone, car rego, da-da-da-da-da. Add it up and say, if that's 52 grand a year, you get paid fortnightly, divide by 26 paydays.
Mm.
So every payday, $2,000 goes into a separate bank account with those fixed expenses. They are now taken care of.
Mm.
You then next allocate how much you're going to save, and that goes into a separate account. Then you can have fun with what's left over. That's not difficult. And you don't have a credit card. Credit cards are poison.
Mm.
You must have a debit card. If you dice the credit card.
That has got through to the current generation. They're much more likely to have debit cards, although they're also more likely to use some of the
afterpay. That's the whole problem.
And if they pay it off on time, there's probably... If.
Well, you know that at the moment they just said this was a Senate inquiry that said that there was no problem with afterpay.
You say no problem? Mm, I mean, I don't know what that means.
That they don't need regulation because it's not. Mm.
Well, yes, but afterpay encouraged you to spend money you don't have.
Mm.
Your old granddad was never going to spend money he didn't have, I'll bet you.
No.
This is the point. If you haven't got it, you don't spend it. It's that simple.
Because
we've built this whole society on you have it now and pay for it later. Well, that's the point. You don't have that mentality. And if you've got a debit card, you cannot pay for what you haven't got.
Exactly.
And you can't get caught. Because one thing I guarantee, when you get the credit card statement, the balance is always more than you expect. Always, because little things add up. And the way they add up on a credit card is how the savings add up. You start to save things. Now, I love RAIZ, R-A-I-Z. It's the old acorns. Every time I buy a cup of coffee, 50 cents goes into my RAIZ account. RAIZ is fantastic for people. I had a photographer here at the house having a bit of trouble. I said, righto, buddy, what you do is every month you put one sale in a RAIZ account, because either they have different gigs. You put one gig in a RAIZ account and don't touch it. He was amazed after 12 months. He had about 10 grand sitting in there because he was spending everything he earned. Okay, well, if you didn't have that gig, you'd still live. We can always cut our cloth, isn't it, to suit what we've got. We can always cut back. That's the point. We're amazed how much we've saved in COVID.
Yes.
We've saved. I mean, we're saving. Well, we don't have to go out for coffee anymore. I've got an espresso virtuo machine, which is brilliant. But here, we're eating healthier. It's great. Mm.
I quite like it too. I do know one thing. Talent that many people wouldn't know about, you know. Apparently you make a wicked pizza.
I make a great pizza. I've been making that for 40 years.
Oh, good. Tonight we'll get to try it. So, Catherine, before we go off to that pizza, is there anything else you wanted to ask Noel?
No, I think that I think there's been some really good information during the session, and I'm actually looking forward to reading the retirement book, even though I'm now not thinking that I'm in any minute about to retire, because that wouldn't be a good attitude.
But the better you plan your retirement and the earlier you start, the easier it is. It's like fitness. It's like your superannuation.
And start the more opportunities you'll have to do different and exciting things.
Absolutely.
You know, if you've planned for it properly.
Of course.
So thank you, Noel and Catherine, for sparing the time to talk to me. If you want to find out more about Noel, there are show notes with each of my episodes, including contact details for each of my guests on my website, www.lorettacreek.com. Please drop me a line if you have any questions or know of someone who may be interested in being interviewed for this podcast. Generally, they should have a law degree.
You have a look at Noel's website, because he's got a lot of calculators that are easier to use than some of the others around. So I suggest you go and have a play of the calculators on the website.
Thank you so much.
And get the newsletter.
Subscribe to the newsletter,
Only uses electrons.
Okay, thanks. Hello, everybody. Here I am with Noel and Catherine. Say hello to me.
What a horrible knot you've got in that, Loretta.
That's an awful thing to say.
Typical.
So how's my voice coming across there?
All right, now I'm going to have a look.
Thank you for joining us on Lunching with Lawyers. If you enjoyed this episode or have questions or comments for our guests, head to the show notes for this episode and click on the contact links below. If you have suggestions, ideas or questions, or would even like to be part of this series, head to the Contact Us page on our website, www.lorettacreek.com.